From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we parse the complex education policy debate playing out this winter in Wisconsin. Then speed skater Bridie Farrell's not going to Sochi, but isn't giving up the sport either.
A lot of people after the trial said, oh, it's too bad that you didn't come back sooner or you don't have more time and have a nice life. And I said, well, actually, I'm going to finish the season and keep skating next year, which surprises a lot of people. But I really love to skate and there's a lot of improvement to be made. And as long as I can physically and physiologically do it, then I plan to keep skating.
And the latest production at the Milwaukee Rep combines the Jewish story of Passover with the freeing of slaves during the Civil War.
What did those people think? That they're having their Seder, they're talking about how we escaped into freedom from Egypt, and they're being served by black slaves. The food was cooked by slaves. There's a huge contradiction.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Nice to have you listening today. It's been a busy winter for debate over education policy in Wisconsin. Lawmakers in Madison, school district officials in Milwaukee and around Wisconsin, parents and even business groups have all contributed to the charged discussion over measures regarding academic standards, school accountability, charter schools, and even real estate. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel education reporter Aaron Richards joins us in the studio this morning to help us make sense of the education policy climate in Wisconsin at this point in time. Nice to see you.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Let's start with the current conversation about Common Core standards, which you have written about just recently. And let me ask what seems like a pretty simple question. Where does their use in Wisconsin school districts actually stand at this point?
Well, 3 years ago, Wisconsin's state superintendent adopted the Common Core state standards, which are a set of academic expectations that most states have now adopted that set some guidelines for what we think kids should be able to know and do at each grade level, all the way from kindergarten to high school graduation. That was really important for Wisconsin because the previous standards in Wisconsin were really vague, and they were only really outlined for 4th grade, 8th grade, and 12th grade. And everybody agreed that they just weren't very strong. And so when this movement came along, the Common Core standards were developed by a group of state governors and Council of Chief State School Officers. And so there was some agreement that if we all, you know, sort of agreed to these loose standards that would give some idea of where we were going, that it would still leave school districts the flexibility to figure out how they were going to teach to accomplish these standards. So Wisconsin adopted them. There was very little fanfare. They were posted online. Some people commented, not a whole lot. They've become much more political now since there have been, as the standards have been aligned to new state tests that are coming out, more people are realizing how significant it is that these standards are in place, they're for everybody, and some people that are in the more conservative wing, mostly in the Republican Party, have said, wait a minute, we think the federal government has had too much influence here. That's left Wisconsin in a bit of a pickle, like some other states. They have a state superintendent who is very much in favor of the standards and says, this is a good thing for our schools and our students, and we're moving forward. We're already implementing these in a lot of school districts. Which is true. You can talk to most superintendents around Wisconsin, and they are indeed having their teachers change what they're teaching, teaching some more difficult concepts at some younger grades, which is a shift. But most teachers have said, yeah, it's kind of bumpy, but we're getting it. It's nothing that's happened overnight. But in the middle of all that, now you have a lot of political discussion about where these standards are and whether there should be a state-mandated council that would review these standards. And so that's where things are at right now. They're being implemented. In some districts, you've seen a little bit more progress than others. But at the moment, we've got some potential legislation that might be introduced to say, let's review these standards or slow them down. And because it's a bit of a political fireball, sometimes you have to read the tea leaves a little bit to figure out where this might be going.
Well, right. And the question that poses itself almost in this case is whether the debate that's playing out right now is more about what's actually contained in the standards or about how the standards were arrived at in the first place.
This is true. One question that I ask a lot of people on both sides of the Common Core debate is, have you actually read these standards? Have you actually looked at what they say and what they're expecting children to do? And oftentimes the answer is, well, some, maybe. And, you know, it's kind of a dry topic, but when people get really fired up about it, it's good to say, okay, wait a minute, what are we actually arguing about? What do you not like? Now, it's not just conservatives that are upset about these standards. Because the standards are tied to some new state tests that are coming out, there is a feeling that what gets tested is linked to what the standards are. So you've got some teachers that are afraid, and some parents too, that the higher standards are going to dictate more difficult tests. Students may not score as well on the test. We roll these out really quickly, and then everyone looks like much more of a lower performing student than they would be otherwise. So the difficulty about the Common Core is that several people are raising concerns from different factions, but they have different concerns about different aspects of it. And certainly the perceived influence of the federal government is a big one for some that are aligned with more of the conservatives. And we're just not seeing much evidence from that. When we write about these things, we point out that, you know, the Obama administration has certainly encouraged states to adopt these, but it has not made them mandatory. You know, the federal government made it clear that they were in favor of higher standards and more uniform standards. But they didn't, you know, punish states in the competition if they didn't pick them up.
And even more recently, there are some districts that are distancing themselves from the Common Core standards. For example, the Germantown School District is taking another look.
That's right. So they've stepped back and they've said, we think we can do better. So we'd like to have standards that better reflect our students and in our community. I think what you're going to see is even people that try to pull back and do something different, you know, they're still going to be very much hinged to the overall standards simply because the new state test coming out is going to test a lot of the concepts. For example, if you're teaching how to tell time, how to read a clock at a younger grade level, you know, you want to make sure that you teach that concept before it gets tested on the state exam. So I don't think you're going to see a huge amount of variation. I think what you might find is, especially in some communities where there are some people that kind of have that federal oversight concern, I think in some ways they may just want to put their own stamp of approval on it. But I still don't think they're, at least not yet, we're not seeing anyone really take a radically different approach.
You mentioned the state school superintendent is a big supporter of the Common Core standards. What do we know about what the governor says about this debate?
Well, you have to remember that the governor is running for re-election. So one of the things that's thrown a bit of a wrench in the messaging lately is that the governor stood up recently before the State Education Convention, which is put on by the State School Boards Association and the Administrators Association. And he said, I'm in favor of reviewing standards. But there's a big difference there between whether you're saying, you know what, we need a better process for reviewing future standards to make sure that we all know what's going on. Because I think, you know, we're looking 3 years back now and maybe there could have been some better messaging up front and some more public push to understand these. I mean, certainly people like me were writing about them, but it's hard to, you know, really rally behind something kind of vague like that early on. But back to the future standards, the governor has said, I'm in favor of reviewing these. The state superintendent has said, we're not going to slow down the current implementation. I'm in favor of reviewing future standards. That's fine. But you're seeing a kind of a block wall there. And I think in some ways, you know, the governor probably needs to acknowledge that there are some people in the Republican Party that are concerned about this. So you're probably not going to see him take a really strong stand there simply because of the political cycle we're in.
And in fact, some of the groups that are pretty aligned with the governor, some business groups are very much in favor of Common Core standards.
And this is where you see the strange bedfellow aspect of the Common Core again. You know, you've got, you know, some teachers raising alarm bells because of the testing cycle. Then you have, you know, the business association and the state really rising up and saying, hey, we need to support these. These are good for our kids. It makes us more competitive. We need to make sure that what a child is learning in 4 hours north should be the same as what kids are learning down in Kenosha.
Now, the reason many originally pushed for Common Core in Wisconsin was to boost academic achievement and benchmarks. There have been some state lawmakers pushing for new accountability standards that would take in all kinds of schools. But that measure appears to have stalled out for lack of support. What exactly did that bill call for, and what had some lawmakers and others lukewarm about the idea?
Accountability for schools is really important because it's one of the few ways we can tell or that we have to tell how schools are doing. At the moment, for the last 2 years, we've had state report cards that come out, and they give us some sense of how most actually all the public schools in the state are doing. Those state report cards don't apply at all to the private voucher schools that participate in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. So part of the accountability bill was supposed to address this disconnect. It was supposed to bring all of the private voucher schools that get public money into the same fold, into the same accountability system as the public schools. So we did see a draft of – or that legislation was introduced, and it did indeed bring the voucher schools into this system. But the second step of accountability for schools is, what do you do with schools that – aren't doing so well? Because an accountability system doesn't mean a lot if there aren't any, sort of rewards or help or sanctions for schools that aren't doing well. The reason why the accountability bill that was introduced has stuck is because you've got it's Republican-led. Part of the outcry from the public schools is that the voucher schools still weren't treated fairly. So that means the accountability bill called for some of the lowest performing schools in the state to be turned into charter schools that would be run independent of the districts. So it would take those out of local school district control. For the voucher schools, it just said that they couldn't accept new students, which would be a financial penalty initially, but it would take a while for that to actually, shut down a school or change its governance structure. So that's why you saw a lot of outcry from the Democrats and from teachers' unions. The problem is, even within the Republican Party, there wasn't universal support for this bill. So another leading Republican said, listen, I want there to be a state accountability council, basically, that would be able to set some of these standards, a la the Common Core, but also be able to judge schools against these standards. That's Senator Paul Farrow from Pewaukee. The concern about that is that that would be putting a lot of power into an entity that isn't publicly elected in the way that the state superintendent is elected. So other concerns is just that, some Republicans have said behind the scenes, they didn't think the bill went far enough to sanction low-performing public schools. They wanted something even more aggressive. So what you're seeing here is a divide within the Republican Party over what to do, A, how to judge schools, and this bill would change the way the state report cards are issued. It would give every school an A through F grade. So there's some concern about how that would be done. And then you've also got the follow-up, which is disagreement over how far sanctions should go.
Well, and MPS obviously has a lot at stake in a measure like this. It also has its own proposal for dealing with struggling schools. What would the district like to see done?
So what we've got are these two parallel efforts that are sort of being talked about at the same time. A few weeks ago, the administration of Milwaukee Public Schools said, listen, we've got 48 schools in our system right now that, according to the current state report cards, are failing to meet state expectations. We would like to propose a variety of reforms for those schools. The least aggressive would be some more in-house reforms. We've seen that a lot over the years. The second plan would be to bring in what you might think of as a business consultant to come in and talk about operations, efficiency, maybe some professional development, contract with somebody that could provide some outside perspective. We've also done that before. The third option, which we haven't done before, is say these low-performing schools are going to automatically be turned over to independent charter school operators. This really gets the teachers' union concerned because it would mean taking these schools out of the control from the school board and giving them to independent operators of charter schools, which are indeed public, but they don't have to answer to the school board in the same way that the traditional schools do. The superintendent did not name which of the 25 schools they were most concerned about of the 48 would be getting these treatments. And initially, the proposal drew a lot of criticism. A lot of people came out to the school board meeting to oppose it. When it went to the full school board did not approve it, and they kicked it back to committee. There was a lot of confusion. There was, again, a lot of people at the meeting, and it just got a little murky. So at the same time that the measure in the state stalled, you also see the measure in Milwaukee stalling, and now we're sort of back to the same drawing board, which is, what the heck are we going to do with schools that chronically underperform? How can we do something different?
And finally, back to MPS, how is all of the rest of this discussion wrapped up in the controversy over old MPS buildings and whether the district should sell them to other school operators?
Again, you see a lot of politics at play here. So this issue, most recently, the one that got the most attention was a really big building on the north side called Malcolm X Academy. Nearby, a couple blocks away, is a high-performing private voucher school called St. Marcus Lutheran School. And the leader of St. Marcus has tried for some time to purchase this building. He would like to expand. He has a lot of kids on waiting lists that want to get into the program. The district instead came up with a proposal to sell the building to a developer who would lease back half of the building to the district while they pay for renovations, would make the other part of it be apartments and a housing complex. It gets to the heart of that debate about, is Milwaukee public schools trying to keep their empty buildings out of the hands of private school operators? In the past, the district and even the school board president has said, you know, these are our competitors. We're in a competitive school environment. You'll hear the superintendent often refer to market share. It sounds cold, but it is also about how you're going to keep a major school system running. Every kid means a certain amount of money coming to whatever entity is teaching that student. So the issue with the empty buildings right now is that the district is moving forward with that plan to sell to a developer. We're not really sure what's going to happen with St. Marcus, but they'll probably have to figure something else out if they're going to expand. Unfortunately, a lot of the other empty buildings that Milwaukee Public Schools have are either not conducive to a school setting right now. They need, you know, a ton of upgrades, or, you know, there's some other reasons why they don't make a great building for schools. And to the district's credit, it has come up with some more innovative uses for these over the years, even in Bayview with them proposing to do this development, which would be housing for teachers in the old Dover Street School. Kind of an innovative concept. I mean, they really did reach out to Baltimore that had done something similar. I think critics would argue, well, they're just, you know, trying to quickly pull together some plans that would keep these, you know, schools off the table. But at the same time, you have to say, well, you know, they are trying to do some things different, and they have found some new uses for buildings that were not being used before. And there are certainly less of them available now than there were even a couple of years ago.
Aaron Richards, thanks so much for helping shed some light on these really pretty complex issues.
Thanks a lot.
Aaron Richards is an education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There is a link to her most recent story on the debate over Common Core standards from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7, listener-supported Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Bonnie North is in the studio with us, and that listener support is the key part of the equation in this case. We are into the home stretch of our winter membership drive, and we have a goal this hour to attain.
We do. $950 to support Lake Effect, also to, of course, to support all the programming that you hear on Milwaukee Public Radio, and it's very easy to do. 414-227-3210. You can go to WUWM.com/give. Make your donation of support that way. The important thing is that you do it. And this is the last time to support during Lake Effect, because we won't be on the air pitching tomorrow. We'll be on the air, but we won't be on the air asking for your support.
That's right. And it means it's your last chance to support the great kinds of context that you get. For example, this interview we just had with Aaron Richards that tried to give you a little bit more than the headlines about the many-headed hydra that is the education policy debate going on in Wisconsin at this time. Just an example of some of the policy stories that we're able to get to in depth in a way that few other places are at this point in time. Call now with your membership support at 414-227-3210 or go online to WUWM.com/give and become a member or renew your membership today. A break now, and then we update the story of speed skater Bridie Farrell, who started her Olympian comeback at the Pettit National Ice Center last year. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Yesterday on the show, Lake Effect sports contributor Howie Magner and I talked about some of the 2014 Winter Olympians with Wisconsin ties. Among them are a healthy contingent of speed skaters from Wisconsin natives Allie Dudek and Sugar Todd to skaters who train in Wisconsin, such as Shawnee Davis and Brian Hansen. Almost exactly a year ago, we introduced you to speed skater Bridie Farrell, a former Olympic short track hopeful who had moved to Milwaukee to train as a long track skater. It was in her time here that she first went public with the story of her sexual abuse by former teammate and mentor Andy Gable. That story and other allegations by other skaters led to Gable's resignation from several skating governing bodies. As the Olympics neared, Farrell moved her training base to Utah, where the Olympic trials were held in December. But alas, despite a solid performance in those races, Farrell will watch the Sochi Games from the United States. She was back in town recently for another race, though, and we caught up with her at the Pettit National Ice Center. Welcome back to Milwaukee.
Thank you for having me.
You've made it through your first Olympic trials in long track. Seasonal personal bests in, I think, every event or three out of the four events you were in, but you're not headed for Sochi. How do you evaluate how the trials went for yourself?
Well, I think that the best part about long track is that you're truly racing against yourself. So if I can post my best times and I don't make the team, then it's hard to really be disappointed by that. Obviously, my goal going into the season was to make the Sochi team, and I'm disappointed that I didn't. However, I think personally, I'm quite happy and satisfied with my performance thus far.
You were less than 2 months removed from gallbladder surgery. How did your health play into what you were able to do in the trials?
The surprise gallbladder removal was definitely not part of the plan. Going into this comeback, I knew or I thought my ankles or knees or other distractions might be a factor, but gallbladder wasn't even on the radar. But that's part of the deal. And so I had my gallbladder removed 7 weeks prior, and yeah, it took away from a lot of my training, and it's still very painful where the incisions were, but I think that if I didn't have it removed, it'd be even worse. So, I mean, it's just part of the game, I guess.
In a way, is that almost, I mean, is something like a gallbladder almost worse than an injury sustained in actually doing the sports? It's totally out of your control.
It is completely bizarre. I mean, it's funny because I was laying in the ER and I was texting my family and I said, I can't believe this. And then a second later, I sent a text message saying, actually, I totally can. And that's what everyone said was, no, this is kind of par for your luck. So, I mean, you just have to roll with it. There's nothing you can do.
Did your doctors, suggest that you take more time off?
I was allowed to start training as tolerated, but the pain, I mean, it would wake me up during the night. And I was back in the ER, I think, three times from the surgery to the Olympic trials. But, I mean, that's a gamble you have to take when you can either sit and let it completely rest and lose a lot of your conditioning, or you can train and say this is the state of the gallbladder and we're going to work through it. So I don't have any regrets on how I did it after the trials. I went back to New York City and rested some. So hopefully, you know, the pain will subside going forward. But yeah, it's just bad luck, I guess.
When you think back on it, we are just a little over a year more than you started training in long track for the Olympic trials just over a year ago. When you think about where you were a year ago as you decided to try to do this and where you are today, what do you think?
Physically, I'm not as happy as I thought I'd be farther along. There's various reasons why I think I'm not skating better, which hopefully I can work on going forward. But in terms of everything else, I mean, my work life is successful. I'm very happy, all those things. So holistically, I can't believe how much has changed and improved in just a year.
What do you think physically is the issue at this point?
Technically and tactically. So if you want to go between long track and short track, they're very similar at the recreational level. But if you want to be a good short tracker or a good long tracker, they are light years apart. I mean, they're just so vastly different. Much like I can go out and skate on figure skates or skate on hockey skates, but that doesn't mean I'm a good figure skater or hockey skater. It's completely different sports, technique, equipment, the whole bit. So technically, I have a lot to work on. And then also tactically, I mean, I'm a very much grew up a short track skater and a pack style racer and do well in that environment, much like a crit bike race I do well in versus a time trial. So I need to learn how to pace myself and properly skate a long track race, which is an all time trial. So there's a lot of room for improvement. I mean, I haven't plateaued at all.
So, but you at this point feel like you're going up enough that I mean, it's teasing you to the point where you know you can get better?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people after the trial said, oh, it's too bad that you didn't come back sooner or you don't have more time and have a nice life. And I said, well, actually, I'm going to finish the season and keep skating next year, which surprises a lot of people, but I really love to skate and there's a lot of improvement to be made. And as long as I can physically and physiologically do it, then I plan to keep skating.
Well, so your goal was to make the 2014 Olympic team. What do you see as – do you have a goal in skating at this point?
I'm trying to figure that out and reassess that, but I think – I know that I can improve a lot, like I said, primarily tactically and technically. So I don't know how far I can get in that. I'm going to give myself at least another year and then reassess.
So you were on the ice in Salt Lake City with the skaters who are going on to Sochi. As – viewers followed the U.S. speed skating team to some degree. What do you think we should be looking for? Who's skating especially well?
Well, the U.S. team is amazing. I mean, it's like if you make it to – you're on the Yankees team, like you're a good baseball player and you stay there long enough, you're going to come home with the World Series. And a lot of that is like the U.S. team that there's so much depth. I mean, if you even go as deep as Sugar Todd, who plays 14th at the Worlds – I mean, that's phenomenal, and she was our fourth-place girl, right? So you have Heather Richardson, Brittany Bowe. They're awesome skaters. You have on the men's side Joey Mantilla in his first Olympics. Shawnee Davis obviously is going to kick butt. So there's a lot of long-track skaters to watch for. And then on the short-track side, Eddie Alvarez is awesome, Chris Krevlin, of course, JR. There's just a lot of depth.
You have been involved in speed skating at a national level for a while now. How do you compare where the U.S. is at this stage of the game to where it has been in years past?
Well, I think long track has always been a force. I mean, you can go back as far as Bonnie Blair, Eric Heiden. Those are some phenomenal speed skaters. And on the short track side as well, that they've been both the men and the women have been good for a long time. I think the women, or I know the women, got a tough break when they were disqualified at the World Cups. That's why if you look at the U.S. short track photo, it's 5 men and 3 women because the women didn't qualify a relay team, and everyone's so harsh on them, but they're good. They're really, really good, and it's a shame that they're not going because they could be medal contenders. But both on the short track and long track side, there's a lot of potential, and the sport has changed so much too, but the U.S. is right there in the evolution with it.
You, as I said, have been skating on a nationally significant level for a while now, and at the same time, it's always been sort of on the cusp. As you watch the Olympics, is it ever difficult to watch?
My difficulty in watching the Olympics isn't missing it as an athlete. My difficulty in watching the Olympics is the facade that the Olympics puts on, and there's so much. I mean, the media shows only the bright stories of the games and the fairy tale endings and all that, but the amount that goes on behind the scenes, and I mean, the USOC is a very white man's country club, and it's the nicest country club in the world to belong to. So for me, it's harder to watch that. It's hard for me to watch the amount of money that goes into it when it's, I mean, how much are we spending on clothes per athlete when that would go to so much in development level? So the sport part, I love it. I mean, I'll watch the sports. I wish they played more of every single race, every single, you know, the guy that gets 20th, not just the U.S. people that win medals. But for me, it's the whole propaganda of the games.
Well, and it is something to think about how, for most of the sports in the Winter Olympics especially, and to some degree in the Summer Olympics, how people really don't give much thought at all into the development process until it's time for the Olympic trials.
Like, for example, a lot of Olympic trials had signs up that said, the road to Sochi starts here. And if that's when you're starting your road, like, it's not true. I mean, I started skating when I was 6 years old, and you – so it takes years and years and years, and the USOC had a good tagline for a while of it's not every 4 years, it's every day, and that's the truth. And I think that both the USOC and U.S. speed skating could do a lot more on the development side.
You're back in Milwaukee as we have this conversation for the National Speed Skating Marathon. It has been an eventful year since your last National Speed Skating Marathon.
It has been one of the most publicly eventful years of my life, for sure. I mean, we had our first interview together about a year ago, and I mean, things just really changed a lot for me.
Bridie Farrell, we will talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Speed skater Bridie Farrell will be back in Milwaukee for the last major race of the long track season at the end of this month. She now calls Utah home. She was in town recently for the National Speed Skating Marathon, in which she set women's track records in both the 25K and 50K races. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Bonnie North is with us in the studio. That interview with Bridie Farrell reminds me that we've done some really compelling and interesting reporting over the past year, including our interview with Bridie Farrell, but much, much more as well. It's really been a ton of stuff that's gone on the
air. It has. We have done over 1,000 interviews on Lake Effect in 2013. We'll probably do at least that many, if not more, in 2014. And it's that kind of behind the scenes, that kind of depth that you come to depend on Lake Effect for. And we hope that you will take a moment right now during this last hour when you can make a contribution during Lake Effect, that you become a member or you renew your membership. You become part of that equation. You can go to WUWM.com/give. You can also call 414-227-3210. And a reminder, you still have time to get into the drawing for Dinner for Two in Chicago at celebrity chef Homaro Cantu's Michelin-starred restaurant Modo. 14 courses with wine pairings. You'd need to do that long track, 25 kilometers, to work that off. There's also included a private indoor farm tour and a private cooking class as well. Of course, you don't have to contribute, but we hope that you will. 414-227-3210, WUWM.com/give.
And we accept gifts in just about any amount. In fact, any amount. Maybe it's $10 for the year. Maybe it's $10 a month. Maybe it's $10 a quarter. The important thing is to give at the level that is comfortable for you. We try to make it as easy as possible, but it only happens when you call 414-227-3210 or you go online to WUWM.com/give and make your membership gift today. One last break and then a preview of the Milwaukee Rep's new production, which weaves together the Civil War and the Jewish story of Passover. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. As the sesquicentennial anniversary of the Civil War continues, it's the perfect time for the Milwaukee Rep to stage one of the most popular productions to hit American theaters in the last few years, the post-Civil War drama called The Whipping Man. But it would be a mistake to call this merely a period piece. The story featuring a Confederate soldier returning to his abandoned and destroyed home and reuniting with two of his family's now former slaves covers themes of identity, religion, and the meaning of freedom. The Rep's production is directed by Brent Hazelton. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce caught up with him during tech rehearsal, which we're hearing some of now. Also on hand was Jody Hirsch. The Judaic Education Coordinator at the Jewish Community Center of Milwaukee was a consultant on the show. That's because the Confederate soldier at the heart of the story was Jewish. Hirsch talked more about the history of Jews in the Confederacy.
There probably at the time were about 20,000 Jews in the South, probably 150,000 Jews in the whole North America at the time. And of those 20,000, we don't have great statistics, but it's thought that maybe a quarter of them had slaves. And most of them, like the De Leon family in this play, were city Jews. They had house slaves. They didn't have plantations and huge numbers of slaves. I mean, there were exceptions, but basically it was probably a quarter of the Jews in the South had slaves.
And while, as you say, most slaves at the time either adopted or were forced to adopt the religion of whoever owned them, there's nothing in the historical record that says there were any Jewish slaves, but it's completely plausible and completely feasible. And given that, you know, the Civil War actually ended on Passover in 1865, there's something so rich about the potential contradictions in there, as Jody was saying, and just the potential sort of mind-bending revelations of how you reconcile that with Judaism.
Passover, of course, is the story of the Jews being led out to freedom. And yet you have these two slaves celebrating the Passover Seder, or I guess at this point in the play, they actually have been emancipated. Talk about some of that complexity.
Well, it's amazing to me just to think of this. Passover, there's all this language about, you know, we were slaves and now we're free, and the Lord brought us out of there with a outstretched arm and a mighty hand and so forth and so on. So it's just, what did those people think that they're having their Seder? They're talking about how we always use the language we, how we escaped into freedom from Egypt, and they're being served by black slaves. The food was cooked by slaves, probably in a Jewish home. The slaves knew all about cooking kosher, but there's a huge contradiction, and I think people just didn't really think about it. It's just the way of life in the South, and it was just the way things were.
And of course, we see that attempt to reconcile these two ideas in Caleb, who has come home to an empty house, injured from the battlefield, and he is celebrating this Passover with two former slaves of his family.
Yeah, it's Caleb's returned, and he's a little shaky in terms of his faith right now. The war has, I think, has called a little bit of that into question, just the vast scale of suffering and destruction. So he's trying to work that out for himself at the same time that Simon, the older of the former slaves, and John, the younger of the former slaves, are also trying to deal with their own newfound freedom. And the Seder for Simon and John is a very active, very affirmative, celebratory. This prophecy, this legend, this story has now come to pass for real. It's become true. So dealing with that, and I think there's a certain element of that in Caleb's receiving of the Seder as well, as he's learning how to accept their freedom as well, you know, and how to sort of see these people as people that he's only seen in one context previous to this, and the world is changing around all of these guys, and they're really struggling to deal with it. And that, for me, is one of the fascinating questions about the play. You know, we have a moment in time where the world has been fundamentally and irrevocably altered, and people have to deal with that. You know, and we see these moments throughout history, you know, whether it's Pearl Harbor or the Kennedy assassination or September 11th, you know, where the world that you go to sleep in at night is fundamentally changed from the world you woke up in the morning and forever will be, and there's no going back. So how do you move forward in that new world? You know, how do you make your peace with that and discover yourself in this new context? And all three of these characters are on that journey, and that's, for me, the most interesting big picture thing about the play is just how do you adapt to an adapting world?
Jody, as you were consulting on this, what perspective did you bring to the understanding of how Jews at that time kept slaves and how, as Jews today, we think about that time in American history?
Well, I mean, part of it is the universal thing. You know, I mean, the slave owners, the slaveholders in the South were clearly on the wrong side of history. I mean, we look at it today and we think, I mean, it's not just Jews. I mean, it's how could we have done such a thing? And the play is about, well, how do they negotiate this new ground? You know, are they friends? Is there something else? Because the black slaves used to be owned by this young white guy. I mean, so I think that what I bring is partly that, you know, talking about modern sensibilities, but partly is, you know, we want this to seem authentic. We want this to seem like what would have happened in 1865 during Passover of that year. I mean, Appomattox, the surrender, Lee's surrender at Appomattox literally happened during Passover. And so there are all these issues. You know, there's a line in the traditional Seder, which they say in their Seder in the play, where we say, every year we say, this year we are slaves. Next year may we be free men. So that's an intriguing thing. You know, we say that now every single year. And so obviously it has this huge symbolic idea. But now if you think about 1863, when here you have the white Jews sitting at their table saying, this year we are slaves, may next year we be free men. And you have these black Jewish slaves serving the white people. And they also say, this year we are slaves, may next year may we be free men. But they're really slaves, literally. So it's just mind-boggling. So I think one thing that I try to bring to it is some kind of sense of authenticity. We've talked about everything. You know, what would they have done? You know, what would they have eaten? Would they have worn something on their heads? And what would that have looked like? And so I'm trying to help them do this accurately, or at least with the sense that it's really accurate.
I think it's interesting you mention what would they have used as the traditional foods of the Seder, because at that time in the South, most places were just ransacked.
Well, and the interesting thing about it is, you know, the first Seder, as we say in the play, was improvised. You know, this exodus out of Egypt, and they're using whatever they have as they go along. You know, and those found objects have now become the traditional elements. But these guys have to come up with their own found objects too. So it's sort of a wonderful reinvention of the whole Seder tradition to fit modern times, but also colored with a really wonderful traditional African-American sense of worship. So you sort of see the ceremony and see the belief system being adopted and internalized by a different group of people who then make it their own, you know, and there's something wonderfully fundamentally American about that too.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting part of the play too, this idea that these two characters, John and Simon, are taking something forced upon them by their masters, yet they're taking on the identity as Jews. And in fact, they kind of wrestle with that. I mean, at one point, I think John asks, are we slaves or are we Jews? And I think that's such a fascinating question of identity that they're all wrestling with in this show.
Right. I mean, at one point, especially Simon talks about it as a gift, you know, that this is a gift that they're Jewish. And yet it's full of these contradictions, which I think are really wonderful. And there's an element of the whole story about redemption. The Jewish tradition talks about a redemption that happened in the past. That's a redemption from Egypt. But it's linked also to a redemption in the future when the Messiah comes. And clearly, for Simon and John, they are being redeemed in the most literal sense. They are emancipated. And I think that the playwright just doesn't miss that connection.
Yeah, and the redemption notion is so important, too. I mean, it's a play about the big picture theme is not necessarily about the Civil War, not necessarily about Judaism, but just freedom in general and how you move ahead in your life as a truly free person. You know, it's real, genuine self-actualization, you know, and this notion that you have to continue to earn it every day and you have to continue to work for it every day, and that you're, as Jody was saying before, you know, this notion of the concept of slavery in the Seder sort of becoming a metaphor in contemporary times. What are your individual enslavements? You know, are you greedy? Are you out of shape? I mean, whatever those things are. But that the Seder itself in Judaism in general, I think, demands that you continue to try to do better, you know, and that redemption is always on the table. You know, you can always improve yourself. You can always improve the world around you. You can always look to do better in some way. And that's sort of Simon's constant refrain throughout the play, trying to get Caleb and John to let go of the past and move on and move ahead, you know, because Simon knows that now there's an opportunity to really and truly be free, and you can't do that if you're still encumbered by the things in your past. So it's really a strong ideological through line throughout the play. How do you let go of the wrongs that have been done you and move ahead? And especially when you're talking about something like enslavement, which is, it's hard to contextualize the scale of that wrong done to another human being. But how do you let that go and move past it? You know, and that goes for Caleb the enslaver as well as John and Simon the enslaved. How do you put that behind you somehow and move on? And to a large extent, I think that's still a question we deal with in America today. You know, how do we really unify ourselves and how do we really move forward collectively?
I wonder if, as an audience member, when you're watching this play and you're feeling that tension and that discomfort as these three characters try to navigate the changing relationships between them, if it doesn't remind you of some interactions you've had with perhaps someone of another race or another class or a different ideology or belief system.
You can't not relate to it, you know, particularly given how polarized our political conversations in this country are today. But there's the sort of dueling notion of freedom in the play, the freedom from or the freedom to, and that perhaps just because you are able to do something, just because you are allowed to do something, perhaps the freer choice is actually not exercising that right, you know? And I think that's the the core of the gun control debate today, you know, simply because you can, should you? Some people would say, yes, that's my right, absolutely. And some other people would say, well, but is it wise in this day and age to really exercise that right anymore? So I think these notions of exercising individual freedom, I mean, they're at the core of the play, and that they're a core of every significant national conversation we're having today. So that, yeah, that uncomfortability will feel really familiar. And I would hate for people listening to this to think that they're going to get some sort of gut-wrenching, you know, emotional, ideological, political diatribe, because that's really not what the play is. I mean, it's three wonderfully, fundamentally human people wrestling with these ideas, but it's that human journey much more than the ideological one that we're exploring here.
When you were rehearsing the show and working through the play, what kinds of conversations were you having amongst yourselves with the cast, the crew, as you were dealing with some of these really raw emotions that the play can provoke?
Well, we spent the first week just sort of doing a dramaturgical week, you know, just reading through the script, talking about the themes, talking about ideas. We went up to Jody's place. He hosted us for a Seder, just actually ran us through one, so we all knew what it was, which was really valuable and a heck of a lot of fun besides. Talked a lot about the Civil War, about sort of the politics behind it, what these characters would have known, what they wouldn't have known. And the play is structured really interesting because it's a period piece, but there's a very heavy contemporary awareness of what was going on in the period. So sometimes the characters speak or operate with knowledge that history and hindsight has granted them a little bit. And not in a way, I just made it sound like that's a terrible fault and a mistake of the play, but I really think it's an advantage because it allows the play to sort of have one foot in each world in a really interesting way. So we talked a lot about the legacy of slavery, you know, and what it means to be in a country that has only not had slaves for 150 years and has had slaves for 300 or 400 years before that, you know. We're not even halfway done with that journey yet, you know, and the notion that everyone sort of expects that we should be there already, I think, is a little tidy and maybe a little false and is preventing us from dealing with real questions that we need to deal with. So we talked about all sorts of stuff in the room, not only in the context of you know, getting everyone's viewpoint on the table as it informs their character, but also in terms of what sort of conversation we want to have with the audience, you know, what do we want them to walk away with?
I really think for me, it was a privilege to be part of this, these conversations, because, you know, the actors are really thinking about their roles. Well, what would Simon have thought about this? Or why? We had a conversation that I was part of just the other day in which every character was talking about, well, why are they coming to the Seder? Why is it important for the character to have a Passover Seder in April of 1865? And what are they thinking about when they do that? And that was such a rich conversation. You know, I'm a teacher, so I talk a lot. So it was really hard for me not to talk a lot during that conversation, but just to listen to them, and it was fantastic.
Well, Jody Hirsch and Brent Hazelton, thank you both so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Pleasure.
Brent Hazelton directs the Milwaukee Reps production of The Whipping Man, which runs through March 16th at the Stimke Studio Theater. The official opening night is this Saturday. Jody Hirsch is the Judaic Education Coordinator at the Jewish Community Center of Milwaukee and consulted on the production. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Of course, arts reporting and arts coverage is a major part of what we do each and every day, each and every week on Lake Effect. Lake Effect's very own Bonnie North is with us in the studio. You do a lot of arts coverage, and, you know, we say this a lot, but it really bears repeating. If not here, then where?
Pretty much nowhere. There's certainly a lot of wonderful reviewers in town, and there are a lot of people writing about the arts, but hearing about it, that's where we excel, and that's where we sort of have a unique place in the media pantheon, because we give artists a chance to talk for themselves. You actually hear them talking about their work, or actually maybe hearing a scene or some music that they're playing.
Right. We take you to tech rehearsal.
Yep.
Sometimes we have musicians that come and play in our studio, or people who do readings in our studio as well. And it's the kind of thing, you know, between that and the interviews that we do and the commentaries and essays we have, it's really only found on the radio and in this one place.
It is. And if you appreciate appreciate that, and we hope that you do. We hope that you will also donate right now. We're trying to raise $950 this hour, and the way you help is by going to wuwm.com/give or call 414-227-3210. There is no donation too small, just as there's no donation too large, of course, either. What's important is that you actually make the call or you go online and you become an active member.
Whether it's $20 for the year or $20 a quarter or even $20 a month that you can afford, please do take advantage of this winter membership drive and become a member or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio, 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. We do have a team of people ready to take your phone call, and we have a team of people here in the studio who say thanks. That's Thursday's show. Tomorrow, our Project Milwaukee series on Black male incarceration in Milwaukee continues, plus a unique approach to music education underway in Shorewood. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.